Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Investigative hardcovers, feminist triumphs, worldly translations. It's been another great year for books. 2018's crop of published works have transported, teased, and tantalized us. They've lifted the curtain on political machinations around the country and provided fantastical escapes. Three close readers from around the country will join us to walk through the great books of the year. We'll look at the themes and trends in publishing, and we'll welcome your thoughts on what you thought were this year's finest reads. This hour, On Point, the best books of 2018. Join us. What is at the top of your list from this year's published works? What books do you recommend, and why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us from Richmond, Virginia is Amanda Nelson. She's executive editor of the literary site Book Riot. She's also the host of the Get Booked podcast. Amanda, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
With us from Austin, Texas is Clay Smith. He's editor-in-chief of the book review magazine Kirkus Reviews. He's also the literary director of the San Antonio Book Festival. Clay, great to have you back as well.
Hi, David.
And with us from Lawrence, Kansas is Danny Kane, owner of The Raven Bookstore, an independent bookseller there in Lawrence. He's also a poet. His collection Continental Breakfast is out next year. Danny, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
So the author, Curtis Sittenfeld, tweeted about this very subject. She wrote, BTW, by the way, if you're wondering if learning if your book is on year-end best lists is like learning if you've been invited to an elementary school birthday party, it totally is. Which I say as a person sometimes invited to the roller skating rink and sometimes not. Clay Smith, why don't you start with us? First, as a journalist, we hear of Kirkus Reviews. If you're involved in the book trade, it's one of the Bibles. But tell us a little bit about what Kirkus Reviews is for our listeners.
Yeah, so Kirkus Reviews, we review books way before they're available to the public, at least several months. So a lot of our subscribers are librarians and booksellers and people in Hollywood who are looking for adaptation ideas. We give a starred review to about 10% of the books we review a year, which is about 8,000 books.
That's a lot of books to review. Let me just be clear. Is 8,000 the books we review or 8,000 the 10% that are getting the stars?
10% of that 8,000 stars.
Fair enough. You've come prepared, Clay Smith, with a reading from one of your top books this year. It's Severance by Ling Ma. Tell me about what drew you to this book.
Yes, so Severance won our Kirkus Prize for Fiction this year. There were 295 fiction books that were eligible. And it's a post-apocalyptic novel set in 2011 as something called Shin Fever turns people into kind of automatons who repeat actions they did frequently in their lives before they got Shin Fever. So they're kind of like zombies, but they don't go around attacking people. Mm-hmm. So the protagonist is Candace Chin. She's a first-generation American whose job is to publish Bibles for different publishers. And the printers are in China, where the fever originates. And everyone keeps saying, post-apocalyptic novels are done. But then one that's sort of unique for having a kind of sly humor to it and for its insights and critiques into capitalism comes along like Severance, and people stop saying that the post-apocalyptic novel is done. Mm-hmm. So I was really happy to see this one come along.
So why don't you read the excerpt that you have from it, the brief element of it?
Yeah, so this is from the very beginning of the book, and this passage just has a wonderful sense of foreboding about what you're going to experience later in the novel. And she writes, "After the end came the beginning, and in the beginning there were eight of us, then nine. That was me, a number that would only decrease. We found one another after fleeing New York for the safer pastures of the countryside. We'd seen it done in the movies, though no one could say which one exactly. A lot of things didn't play out as they had been depicted on screen."
Clay Smith, do you see this as driven by concerns about, climate change? Is this more about the tumult emotionally that the author is in? What do you see this illuminating? What is this a metaphor for? Or is it just escapism?
No, it's not just escapism. I mean, it is. It's a quick read. It has a really compelling plot that really pulls you through the novel. But Ling Ma, the writer herself, is a first-generation American, and so is her protagonist. So there's great insights here about immigrants coming to America. It's also really thoughtful about Americans' relationships to our jobs and whether we need to sort of rethink how tightly bound we are to our jobs and how they define us.
Amanda Nelson, as I look at the New York Times bestsellers, currently the combined print and ebook fiction show authors with somewhat familiar names, Janet Ivanovich, David Baldacci, Lee Child, John Grisham, Leanne Moriarty. How were the books this year? How would you grade this year in books?
Oh, I think it was such an excellent year. Yes, there were all of these really familiar names that hit the New York Times bestseller list and all of the bestseller lists, as they generally do, because name recognition is a real thing. But at the same time, so many debut voices came onto the scene this year. There were such excellent steps taken in genres and mysteries and science fiction and fantasy. And we got so many memoirs and works of nonfiction about culture and politics, especially considering what's happening, you know, in the cultural conversation right now. Books about that are starting to come out after the election specifically. So I think it was a really, really good year.
So unpack some of those memoirs that you're talking about, particularly for the moment. Let's talk about the political memoirs, The Age of Trump. What one struck you as having some weight, as having some lasting meaning?
Well, Becoming just came out. I mean, Michelle Obama's memoir, which is probably going to be the biggest book of the year, sales-wise. And, of course, Hillary Clinton's book, What Happened. There was Fear, which was a big bestseller. All of these, both inside the administration books and outside the administration looking in, kind of thoughtful considerations of what's happening.
Fear, the Bob Woodward book that did some investigating.
Yep.
Can you name – I mean, can you – when you think back on a book like that as a culture, can you think back to, oh, I remember this anecdote from that book. I remember, you know, what I learned about this. Or do you think, yeah, that really said something to me at the moment, but boy, I can't remember the details anymore.
I mostly remember an abiding sense of terror, to be honest. I don't remember any particular anecdotes from Fear or Hillary Clinton's book, What Happened, but they did – I was comforted by Clinton's book. I remember coming away with that feeling of comfort. And when I read Fear, that was more about
dread.
Confirmation of my own fear. Right.
Exactly. From your standpoint.
Mm-hmm. So they were, I don't know that we'll look back on these political memoirs this year and remember them as, you know, particularly intellectual, or we'll pull away any kind of facts for later consideration. But I think the emotions that they have given to readers, whether it's hope or a confirmation of our own sense of dread, will be important.
Danny Kane, as you think about what to stock and what not to at the Raven Bookstore there in Lawrence, Kansas, what trends did you see in terms of the books that came your way and what things stood out?
I think Amanda, excuse me, hit on the political nonfiction being huge this year. The Bob Woodward was massive for us. Michelle Obama is selling like crazy. We can't keep her new book Becoming on the shelf. But in particular for us, and I think this is true of indie bookstores across the country, what is really interesting is when the political and the local intersect. Our number one book of the year was Heartland by Sarah Smarsh, which is a memoir of growing up poor on a farm outside of Wichita that calls for a more nuanced understanding of politics in the Heartland. And Sarah's a Kansas author. She currently lives in Wichita, but she spent time in Topeka and Lawrence. She did a big author event here. But people were especially excited about that book because, yes, it addresses the current political situation and perceptions of the Heartland. But it's also the local connection is very strong at indie bookstores across the country. Six of our top 10 bestsellers for the year so far have some sort of local connection.
I assume that that's, you know, that you probably wandered in the opposition. Lawrence, being a liberal college town, probably has more than one bookstore around. I imagine a Barnes & Noble there, among others. When you walk in there, what's the distinction between what you have on the shelves and what they do in terms of new books?
Sure. I think a small bookstore like us, it's much easier for us to respond to the needs of our community. A Barnes & Noble has to has to answer to a corporation, whereas the Raven, we're a very small operation, and we can really tailor to the needs and desires and trends in our community. And we're quite proud of that. Mm-hmm. Also, we have two store cats, Dashiell and Nio, which is you definitely won't find in a big chain.
Amanda Nelson, I wanted to briefly ask you, one of the books you cite as the best of the year was by Sujata Massey called The Widows of Malabar Hill. I remember Sujata. I was a reporter, a young reporter of Baltimore Sun in the early 1990s. She had just left the Evening Sun and was working for Johns Hopkins. And boom, she's been writing books now for years. Tell me about what spoke to you about that book.
It is a sneaky feminist masterpiece wrapped up in a cozy whodunit, which is just a work of complete genius. I know, it's so good. It takes place in the 20s in Bombay. It's about a woman who works for her father's law firm. She's the first female lawyer in India, and she has to solve a mystery, a murder mystery, that takes place in the house of three Muslim women who are in mourning who can't interact with any men. So the police can't come in. Their lawyer, her father, can't come in, so she's tasked with this job of going in and defending these women from, you know, all comers and finding out who committed this crime. And while that's all happening, you know, Sujata was talking about colonialism and the effects of colonialism and feminism, early feminism in India, and all of these big social and cultural issues wrapped up in this like very cozy mystery.
And do you find that as a theme in her writing, or is this something new for her?
Oh, it is. Yes, yeah. I think so. Especially historically, exploring those sorts of historical aspects where feminism and the voice of women has been historically forgotten.
And Danny Kane, very briefly before our first break, you know, there have been a number of books that you thought were very strong with international themes, some even in translation.
Yeah, I think it's a great year for fiction in translation. Convenience Store Woman was one of my top five, which is this sly fable about commercialism in Japan. Disoriental by Negar Javadi was another great book translated from the French. I think we're kind of in a golden age of translated fiction. You see Elena Ferrante on HBO. The National Book Award brought back its translation prize. So I was super thrilled with all the translated fiction we saw this year.
You're hearing there the voice of Danny Kane, owner of the Raven Bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas. We also have us with Kirkus Reviews editor-in-chief Clay Smith and Amanda Nelson of Book Riot. We're taking a look at the best books of 2018. You can join our conversation. What are the books that moved you or made a strong impression in your book group? We'll be posting some of your favorite books of the year at our website, onpointradio.org, along with our guest top picks. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're wading deep into the stacks to check out some of the top books of 2018, those books that have moved, enlightened, and left lasting impressions on us as readers. You can join our conversations. What questions did you hope to answer through the books you read this year? What books changed your thinking? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Amanda Nelson. She's executive editor of Book Riot, Clay Smith, editor-in-chief of Kirkus Reviews, and Danny Kane. He's owner of the Raven Bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas. A couple of listeners are posting online. Outrider posts on our website, if more time were spent reading high-quality books, we'd be a much better and more civil society. Compliments to On Point for presenting such an enlightening segment. Suck-ups will only get you so far, but I'm happy to have that affirmation for this hour. Also, a listener under the name Eric Alexander says, offers us Certain American States, Catherine Lacey, my favorite read of the year. Clay, anyone can weigh in on that one?
A Certain State by
Certain American Lacey. States by Catherine Lacey. Any of you guys read that one?
I haven't heard of it.
Well, there you go. We'll post a link to that book on our site later today. We can explore a little bit. One thing I wanted to pick up on was the question of nonfiction books that are exploring our political age, maybe not through the question of memoirs. But are there any of them, Amanda Nelson, that struck you as exploring it maybe a little bit sideways, looking at it rather than just sort of talking about the Trump presidency, but talking about the moment we're in?
Sure. Well, actually, two of the books that I picked for this segment, I think, do that. What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia and Educated, which is a memoir about a girl's experience growing up in a very fundamentalist Mormon survivalist family in, I think it's Idaho. And both of these books come at it sideways. They're not talking about – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, why don't you talk a little bit about the What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia. Set up the book for us, and then I'll ask you to read a little excerpt from it.
Okay, sure. This was published early in the year, I think in February, and it's really a response to J.D. Vance's book Hillbilly Elegy, which also came out in response to the election. And in addition to that, to think pieces and articles that have been coming out since the election about how Appalachia is, you know, backwards and perhaps a little xenophobic and racist and conservative. And if we could just understand the pain of the white working class voter, then we can understand this moment that we're in culturally. And Elizabeth Catt, who wrote What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia, is saying that that is all kind of basic nonsense, you know, that the region is much more diverse than we give it credit for and is getting increasingly more diverse at a rate that's actually faster than a lot of other regions in the country. And that historically, Appalachia is very progressive, especially when it comes to issues of the environment and labor. But the modern or the current contemporary narratives that we're telling ourselves about the region are that it is, you know, this other way, this very monolithic, one narrative kind of way. And in the book, she makes the point that we're doing that as a nation so that we can absolve ourselves of our own responsibility in our own communities for creating this political climate. Because if we other Appalachia and say, well, it's those people who think that way, it's those people who don't value education, it's those people who are racist, then we don't have to address those issues in our own lives. So it was very enlightening.
Why don't I let you read that excerpt, and then I want to ask you a question about that.
Okay. She says, many Appalachians are poor, but their poverty has a deep and coherent history rooted in economic exploitation. The coal industry is no longer a significant employment sector in Appalachia, but the dominance of coal's extractive logic has permanently ruined people and land in ways with which we must still contend. The people of Appalachia are predominantly white, but the region is adding African-American and Hispanic individuals at a rate faster than most of the nation. The average Appalachian is not, then, a white, hyper-masculine coal miner facing the inevitable loss of economic strength and social status, but the average Appalachian's worldview may be impacted by individuals with cultural capital who are constantly assuming we are all made in that image.
So this is seen as a corrective, right, for Hillbilly Elegy and for other related writings. And yet when that came out, that was heralded as a way of understanding a region often neglected by the mainstream media, by authors, by political elites, and by much of the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. Is this a corrective? Does it negate? I mean, is there no truth left to be found in Hillbilly Elegy because this follows it? Or you know, would we be saying the same about Hillbilly Elegy, you know, were we doing this a year or so ago, saying, my God, the guy has finally gotten this right?
No, I mean, it is a corrective because Hillbilly Elegy, while it does attempt to tell the story of a region of the nation that is often ignored. The story it's telling is one man's perspective, but he paints it as prescriptive. He paints it as this is what the region is like. My family's experience and my personal experience is how Appalachia is. And if people followed the steps that I took, then we could solve all of these issues. And her book, Elizabeth Catt's book, is a response to that line of thinking, that the region is X. And if we did Y, we could fix it.
Clay Smith, you see it the same way?
I do. I mean, that you know, the coverage around Hillbilly Elegy really and of course, that book sold well for so long. I mean, it was really seen as, you know, this is the one way. J.D. Vance's story is the one way out of Appalachia. And you got this sense, you know, after that book came out that, you know, there have to be other stories. And so it's just so wonderful to see this book that Amanda is mentioning come out earlier this year.
I'd like to take a call now from Burlington, Vermont. Justin, tell us about your reading.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to just say that I read RX, A Graphic Memoir by Rachel Lindsay. and I thought it was very current, very accessible, and kind of speaks to a lot of issues that I think a lot of us, face, and it's just written in a very beautiful and accessible way.
Justin, can you tell me a little bit about the plot or the story in there?
Yes, it's about prescription drugs and the author's experience with them, working with an advertising company that worked in the pharmaceutical industry, and it's kind of just a memoir of her journey, and it's very unique and funny and just well put together.
Terrific. Thank you so much for that recommendation, Justin. Earlier this year, I got a chance to speak with the author of Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. Her name is Beth Macy. I spoke with her last month here on Point. We discussed what the opioid crisis really looks like for families dealing with addictions across the United States.
What we really need are policies to address the root causes, which are mental health issues and socioeconomic despair. I mean, there's a kid in my book who's interviewed, or one of his teachers asked him in middle school, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he says, I want to be a drawer. And she goes, oh, you want to be an artist? And he goes, no, I want to be a drawer. I want to draw Social Security disability, because that was the only thing he could imagine, because that's what he saw around him.
That just broke my heart when she said that and when I saw that in her book. Clay Smith, you picked Dope Sick. The full title is Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. That company is, goes by the name Purdue Pharma. You picked that book by Beth Macy as one of your five best of the years. Why did it speak to you?
You know, this one is a tough read, but as you got a sense there in the quote from Beth, it's also a really humane and compassionate book. Beth Macy is an investigative journalist from Southwestern Virginia. And sometimes when we get works of investigative journalism, you know, we get the facts and all the good, so to speak, but maybe not all the humanity. And she just does such a great job of making you feel like you know these victims of opioid addiction, the doctors who are trying to help these patients. So it just really puts a human face on the opioid epidemic, which I sometimes feel like in normal news coverage of that epidemic, we sometimes don't get.
Mm-hmm. Danny Kane, you mentioned a number of books on the list that you wanted to suggest and recommend to our listeners. One of them was by Tommy Orange called They're There. Tell us a bit about that book and why you like it so much.
They're There is this amazing debut novel by Tommy Orange, which tells a story I myself hadn't seen in fiction before. It's the story of the urban Indian experience in America. And so it's this kind of kaleidoscopic story of 12 or 13 characters converging on a powwow in Oakland, in the parking lot of the Oakland Coliseum. And Tommy's writing style is just full of pyrotechnics. After this sweeping prologue that basically tells the entire story of Native American oppression, we rotate through these 13 different characters as their lives converge through violence, through love, through family connections. And then this powwow becomes this kind of explosive climax to the whole thing. I think the writing style was super interesting. And the story was an essential one that needed to be told. And in that prologue, Tommy talks about how the Native American experience has moved from what we traditionally think of as the landscape of the reservation or into the cities. And I love that book. It's super relevant, very political, and a great novel to top it off.
We're getting callers calling in with their what they're suggesting we should dip into. Jim is calling from Waynesboro, Virginia. Jim, go ahead.
Well, I think the book that I'm bringing to your attention this morning is one that is receiving a lot of praise. It's a brilliant book, and when I tell you that it's a history of the United States, you may think, well, how boring. I will hasten to tell you also that it is brilliantly written. It reads, the prose style of the author, who is Jill Lepore, a Harvard professor, has tackled a 900-page history of the the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The title of it is These Truths. It is, I think it's probably one of the best books that I've ever read, and certainly it is never out of date because of the nature of the topic. But this lady has written so lucidly and covering just an amazing number of topics and weaving them into a fabric, explaining the roots of our, actually the roots of our current problems.
Uh-huh.
So I would just like to add These Truths as truthfully one of the best books that could be possibly relevant to today.
Well, thank you for that recommendation, Jim. I appreciate it. My colleague Meghna Chakrabarty interviewed Jill right here on On Point earlier this year. We'll make sure to post a link to that interview on today's page. I also wanted to hear from Diane. She's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'd like to recommend, I guess, three books, and they all deal with similar themes. Two are by Timothy Snyder. One is called On Tyranny, and the other by him is The Road to Unfreedom, and then How Democracies Die,
mm-hmm.
By Stephen Levitsky.
Mm-hmm.
And they all three speak to the road that America is traveling rather rapidly toward an autocratic kind of system.
You'd also said that there was another kind of book that you had read that really caught your interest as well.
Yes, there was, and I was told that it wasn't published in 2017 or 2018, but
we are trying to stick to 2018 there. Well, we appreciate that, Diane. Thank you so much. And I wanted also to see if we could go to Green Bay, Wisconsin, to Carol Lee. I think she has a pertinent question for our moment. Carol, go ahead.
Hi. I don't have a suggestion, but I do have a question. I'd like to know if there are recommendations for books in 2018 that weren't full of dark and doom, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, because it seems like we've cut the number on that for 2018. And if I do some Christmas gifting, I'd like to give something that isn't smarmy and isn't partisan, but has some sense that there's a way to look at things in a hopeful way.
Thank you so much for that, Carol Lee. Amanda Nelson, help us out there. What's going to bring tidings of nonpartisan joy?
Romance. That's the answer.
So what do you got for us?
You need to pick up a romance novel. I would say The Wedding Date by Jasmine Guillory is a lovely contemporary romance story about a woman and a guy who meet in an elevator. Like, it's an adorable meet cute. He needs a date to a wedding, and she is kind of, an uptight workaholic sort of type of person, and she agrees to go with him as a way to loosen up. And, it's a romance, so you know how it ends. But it's great escapism. It's a wonderful contemporary story. It's not a Regency, so you're not, like, in your corset or your bonnet or anything. You're just in 2018, happy, which is something I think we all need.
You also recommended a book by Rebecca Roanhorse called Trail of Lightning. Tell us about that book.
Yeah, that's not happy. That's a dark one. This is this is science fiction. It's a post-apocalyptic novel. And I felt about this book the same way.
So this is the second, interestingly, the second one on a best of list, right? This is,
yes.
We're living in somewhat dark times.
Yes, and I had the same reaction that Clay had to Severance, where I was reading it thinking, like, post-apocalypse is kind of, whatever. Like, we're living in it. I don't really want to read about it. But she took the tropes of that genre and really just flipped them around in such interesting ways. So it's post-apocalyptic, wherein the apocalypse is climate change. So the world is basically drowning, and people are fleeing the coast of the U.S. and moving to the center of the country to Dene Tah, which is the Navajo reservation, both because it's, geographically convenient, but also because the gods and monsters and heroes of Navajo legend have come to life and are walking, amongst humans and interacting with us. So it's, kind of the place to be. It's a political, economic, and social center of this new country now that we have no coastlines.
Danny,
the main character.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Please.
The main character is Maggie. She's a monster hunter. She is like this Jessica Jones kind of noir figure. She's hard-drinking, foul-mouthed. She'd much rather punch you than hug you. It's just a super fun, fast-paced mystery with, you know, all of these mythological elements told from an indigenous perspective, which we don't really get much of in science fiction or in American literature in general until very recently.
Why don't you read us that excerpt that you have?
Okay. When I was 14, before the big water, when the TV still worked and the melting of the polar ice was generating reports of record storms from Florida to Maine, and the flooding along the eastern seaboard made Hurricane Sandy look like the female rain of a light summer shower, Coyote came to me. He came in a dream that first time. He would wait another year until I had lost not just my family and my place in life, but my entire self to manifest physically. But it is still that first time when Coyote in a dream visited me before I woke up to the nightmare of a big water world that I remember best.
That from Trail of Lightning by Rebecca Roanhorse. Briefly, Danny Kane at the Raven Bookstore. Do books like that go off the shelves?
Yeah, I was thinking The post-apocalyptic, of course, is a large trend. It's been discussed before, but this interesting, I've heard it called cli-fi or climate fiction, whereas what Amanda was saying was where the villain or the apocalypse is climate change is definitely a trend that we've seen. Another great one is Gold Fame Citrus by Claire V. Watkins. It wasn't this year, but it's another really great book where the apocalypse is the climate instead.
Cli-fi, you never know what you'll learn here at On Point. We're discovering the Literary Year in Review, 2018's best books. You can join our conversation. What books are on your gift list this year? Your wish list? What are you looking for at the bookstore or even on Amazon? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and we're taking a look at the year in books. You can join our conversation. Are there books you're still hungry to read waiting on your bedside table? What are you in the mood for? Are there books that made you mad? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Amanda Nelson. She's executive editor of Book Riot, Clay Smith, editor-in-chief of Kirkus Reviews, and Danny Kane, owner of the Raven Bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas. We've got a call from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Jim, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I've just finished reading the Beastie Boys book, written primarily by Adam Horovitz and Mike Diamond, the surviving members of the band. And it was an amazing adventure looking at the late 70s, early 80s, and the intersections of punk rock, reggae, disco, hip-hop. And I just enjoyed it more than I even expected to.
Thank you so much for that, Jim. You fought for your right to read. We appreciate it. Clay Smith, did this book come across your radar, or were there other bios that surprised you in how much you liked it?
Yeah, I mean, this one shows, you know, the Beastie Boys still sort of experimenting. I mean, it doesn't really fit into, you know, the narrative structure of a traditional rock memoir, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So it just was so nice to see them still, you know, experimenting and giving readers and their fans new material. So and people are really taking to it. I mean, it's selling really well. So it was great to see that.
And were there other books that were biographies that in some ways surprised you in terms of how much you liked it or what they were able to capture?
You know, not so much biography. I mean, I think the biography that came out this fall in October about Frederick Douglass by David Blight, you know, big book, 700 pages, I think. I mean, it's been getting great reviews, but he really puts Frederick Douglass at the center of the political action and the time in which he lived. And so it just was, it was really nice to see that. There was a memoir that I really enjoyed this year, You're on an Airplane by Parker Posey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd be the first to say,
I wanted you
maybe,
to talk about that one.
Yeah. I mean, this book isn't maybe for everyone. The structure is kind of erratic. So if you're looking for, you know, strictly linear narrative, maybe this isn't the book for you. But this memoir is unlike any other celebrity memoir. And it, the earlier caller was asking about, you know, books that maybe aren't so dark. This would fit into that category. Parker Posey is often called the queen of indie movies. You've probably seen her in some of those Christopher Guest movies like Waiting for Guffman.
She's great.
And yeah, she is great. And she has this irrepressible spirit. She's quirky. She's so funny. She's a great comedic actress. And this book contains all of that. It's so full of life and funny and self-deprecating with great insider stories about Hollywood. And in a moment where there is so much political fear and anger and so much intellectual orthodoxy, this book just feels so fresh and unique, and I love it.
You mentioned the Frederick Douglass book by Professor David Blight at Yale. My colleague Meghna interviewed him earlier this month. We'll make sure to post a link to that. One of the nice things about On Point is you have this rich, rich archive of people that you get to talk to. We have a listener who called in, or who wrote in on Twitter saying, I'm enjoying or at least appreciating Rage Becomes Her by Soraya Shamali. She writes, many women are reading it. Men should read it, too. Meghna interviewed Shamali about her book on September 12th. You know, it is often coupled with a book by Rebecca Traister, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, a book about women's anger, a book about Rage Becomes Her about women. Amanda Nelson, is this a year in which you're seeing sort of the literary or writerly expression of the frustration many women feel at the current moment?
Yes, both in fiction and nonfiction. I mean, there was Brittany Cooper's book, Eloquent Rage, and they all have rage in the title. Like, it's not being hidden anymore. It's not being written into, you know, sort of small narratives of domestic fiction, though those still have amazing value and can be so, so great. But just open essay collections about how women are done and mad.
And what do you, are these books saying something discrete from one another, or are they all making the same case?
I don't think they're all – no, they're not all making the same case. Brittany Cooper's book, for example, Eloquent Rage, is specifically about the rage experienced by African-American women, which can be different than the rage experienced by white women or any other intersections of disability or class or any of those things. So I think they all do have – they're all making different points. But the interesting thing about it is that now people are listening. And I think that women's rage has been in our writing forever. I mean, you know, Virginia Woolf was a very angry writer, but now it's become almost mainstream to publish these big, angry collections of nonfiction, honest thoughts and personal anger.
Danny Kane, you run the Raven Bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas. You provide us a list with a handful of your favorite books. You're a champion of one called The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. Tell us a little bit about this book.
The Great Believers is this amazing, sweeping, I would even say epic novel that starts in the early years of the AIDS crisis in Chicago. I was lucky enough to see Rebecca speak about this book, and according to her, there's been no book-length study, fiction or otherwise, about AIDS effect on Chicago itself. Her tools are a novelist, and she aimed to correct that with this book. But even beyond telling that essential story, this is a novel that takes great care with its characters, has a cast that's intensely memorable and likable, and is very clever in its structure. So I think just about everything a novel can do, this book does, and I loved it a lot, and it stayed with me. I read it early before it came out, and it has stayed with me all year.
And tell us the name of the main character.
We've got the central – the main character is Yale Tishman. He is an assistant at an art gallery at Northwestern University. And in the central couple, his partner is Charlie, and their romantic relationship kind of forms the core of this book. But it revolves around this group of friends in the 80s, these young men, this gay community, kind of reckoning with the advent of AIDS.
So why don't you read from us the excerpt
sure.
we selected?
This is early in the book. It's the introduction of another character named Richard, who's a photographer. And it's the scene of this scene is on the Belmont Rocks on Lake Michigan. It was heaven. Even if Yale had forgotten a towel, even if he always burned, guys making out in broad daylight, a gay space hidden from the city but wide open to the vast expanse of Lake Michigan. One of Charlie's friends, a man with wavy, prematurely silver hair and a lime green Speedo, had sat there clicking away on his Nikon, changing film, clicking again at all of them. Yale asked, "Who's the perv?" And Charlie said, "He might be a genius." That was Richard. Of course, Charlie saw genius in everyone, prodded them till he discovered their passions and then encouraged those, but Richard really was talented. Yale and Richard were never close. He'd never set foot in the guy's house till today, but Yale had grown used to him. Richard was always on the periphery, watching and shooting, a good 15 years older than everyone in their circle, paternal, doting, eager to buy a round. He'd bankrolled Charlie's newspaper in the early days, and what had started as a strange quirk had become, in the past few months, something essential. Yale would hear the cameras click and think, he got that at least, meaning whatever happens in 3 years, in 20, that moment will remain. And that if there's a sense of foreboding at the end of that, I think that's accurate. But I see a parallel to what Rebecca Mackay is doing in capturing this moment in time. She does it very well, almost like a photographer on the periphery of this scene.
What a lovely image. What a way to capture that. We have a caller from New Orleans, Louisiana. Marion is calling, who may have a title familiar to you, Danny. Go ahead, Marion.
Hi. Yeah, my favorite book of 2018 was Calypso by David Sedaris. Mm-hmm. I thought it was brutally honest and hilarious in its honesty in a lot of ways, and at a time when humor is much needed.
Thank you so much for letting us know that, Marion. Also, the listener, Bob Long, wrote in saying, massive thumbs up to David Sedaris' Calypso. Just re-listened to it over the holiday, so an audiobook. An instant, but not always funny, classic. Danny Kane, you picked this book as well.
Yeah.
What, you know, we feel like, you know, public radio listeners feel like they have not only some knowledge, but some ownership of David Sedaris.
Sure.
Because he's a frequent presence here. What's, you know, what captured you? What caught your attention about this book in particular?
I love David Sedaris. I read every book, and I think Calypso is his best book, in part because we're seeing Sedaris do something a little bit new here, in which is his voice and his humor, as always, is present here, and there are things that will make you laugh until you cry. But as Sedaris himself ages, as his family ages, as tragedy touches his family, this his sister Tiffany commits suicide in the space covered by this book, that darkness lends a real gravity to his work that I haven't seen before. And there are parts of this book that are just so nakedly honest, stripped away of the usual wit and charm that we know from David Sedaris. And that undercurrent of darkness just makes this book so much more appealing to me, and it makes the humor hit even harder, the fact that there's this darkness lurking underneath.
Why don't you read that as well, the excerpt?
Yeah, sure.
This,
and this is one of those passages, this might even seem shocking as coming from a David Sedaris book, but this is one of the passages without the humor that's just naked honesty. The last time I saw my sister Tiffany was at the stage door at Symphony Hall in Boston. I just finished a show and was getting ready to sign books when I heard her say, "David, David, it's me." We hadn't spoken in 4 years at that point, and I was shocked by her appearance. Tiffany always looked like my mother when she was young. Now she looked like my mother when she was old, though at the time she couldn't have been more than 45. "It's me, Tiffany." She held up a paper bag with the Starbucks logo on it. Her shoes looked like she'd found them in a trash can. "I have something for you." There was a security guard holding the stage door open, and I said to him, "Will you close that, please?" I had filled the house that night. I was in charge. "Mr. Sedaris." "The door," I repeated. "I'd like for you to close it now." And so the man did. He shut the door in my sister's face, and I never saw her or spoke to her again.
Ah, just haunting.
Right, and when you combine that with the usual hijinks and hilarity, it's a book with a tremendous emotional range, and I think that range is as wide as it's ever been for a Sedaris book, and that makes this that much more memorable.
Clay Smith, not only are you the editor-in-chief of Kirkus Reviews, in some ways the Bible or one of them for the book review business, but you're also literary director for the San Antonio Book Festival. As you wander around a book fair like that, an event like that, where do you direct people who say, just say, I want a great read?
Well, I would actually direct them to The House of Broken Angels by Luis Alberto Urrea, a novel that came out in March. This book, I mean, it was reviewed widely, but I feel like it deserves more readers and attention than maybe it got when it first came out. And that's because it's really funny. It has such a big heart, just a wonderful heart to this book. It's a big family saga that asks what it means to be American and really more deeply what it means to be part of a family. And there's tragedy to it, but there's also a lot of warmth. And it's the story of Miguel Angel de la Cruz, or Big Angel, as he's known, who has to bury his mother as he himself is dying. And he's a kind of a restless, trickster kind of guy. So her wake kind of becomes his final birthday party that he throws himself. And Urrea, the novelist, modeled Big Angel, or at least kind of his circumstances, on his own oldest brother, who died a month after their mother's funeral. So I just highly recommend this to everyone, because it's really about family and what it means to be an American.
What do you do in constructing a festival like that that might be different than something that Danny or other booksellers might do in thinking about what to stock?
I mean, that's a great question. I have to kind of put off my book critic hat and put on my show producer hat, because I'm really, in addition to whether a book is any good, I'm asking myself and trying to find out through YouTube or other means whether a writer is a good performer. And not all writers are. Nowadays, writers know that they're expected to perform. But sometimes you have to pull out tricks to, you know, put them on a panel with other writers who are really engaging. And you've got to figure out which writers like to be on panels with one another and which already have done so. And you're trying to make literature, you know, into a production. Whereas normally reading is such a private experience. It's between a writer and a reader. And you're turning it into a show, and it's a challenge that I love to do.
Before we round out the hour, I'd love to take a quick call or two. Lita is calling from Plainfield, Vermont. Lita, go ahead.
Hi. My very favorite book this year was Richard Powers' book, The Overstory.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Powers, whom I think is a genius, often writes of music and science. And in this one, he concentrates a lot more on science. And I found it to be a deep and heartbreaking look at trees and forests and the present and future of the planet through the eyes of 9 compelling characters who all take risks in the woods. And it's long, but it's worth every single beautifully written sentence. I couldn't put it down.
I love that you shared that with us. Thank you, Lita. And Jeff from St. Petersburg, Florida, go ahead. Tell us your reading.
Hi, my favorite book was Arthur Ashe by Raymond Arsenault.
Mm-hmm.
Really thoroughly researched, and it showed him, beyond being a tennis player, a great tennis player, showed his work with civil rights and social justice, and at the end of his life, AIDS awareness.
Well, thank you for that, Jeff. An endorsement of Arthur Ashe, A Life by Raymond Arsenault, a biography, of course, of the tennis great civil rights advocate, and who later in life talked about his own affliction with AIDS, from which he died after a blood transfusion. Clay Smith, did you get to see anything about the Ashe biography or the book by Powers?
Yeah, I mean, that book got great attention and really nice reviews. I haven't read it myself, but it felt to me like that kind of biography that sort of I mean, you wouldn't really say that Arthur Ashe was exactly forgotten, but, you know, he hadn't been written about in a while. And so it was just nice to see his story resurrected. It's really what a biography should do, I feel like.
And that is our hour on books. We've been speaking. You just heard the voice there of Clay Smith. He's editor-in-chief of Kirkus Reviews. Clay, thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
Thank you, David.
We've also been speaking with Amanda Nelson, executive editor of Book Riot. Great to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
And Danny Kane, owner of the Raven Bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas. Thanks for sharing your insights and your passions with us about books of 2018.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on the Twitters and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Puri. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.